Hello and welcome to the Pastcast. I'm Callum Henderson. Coming up on this week's episode...
It was quite a common thing for people's estates to be seized if they fell out with the king at the time. But a seized and destroyed is quite unusual. It implies a very bad falling out.
What the discovery of a 12th century smithy in Cheveley in Cambridgeshire reveals about a dark period of the surrounding area's history. Plus, how the only surviving landing craft tank from D-Day has been reopened as a museum in Portsmouth. Thanks for tuning in. This podcast is brought to you by The Past, a brand new website that brings together the most exciting stories and the very best writing from the realms of archaeology, history, heritage, and the ancient world. You can subscribe to The Past today for just $7.99 a month by visiting our website at the-past.com/subscribe. Now, the village of Cheveley in Cambridgeshire has 10th century origins. Located close to the Suffolk border, during the medieval period, it lay some 13 kilometres from the southeastern edge of the Fens. Now largely reclaimed, the Fens were once a network of marshes, waterways, fisheries and valuable fertile land. When Headland Archaeology excavated the site, ahead of a housing development in 2015, there was every expectation the medieval village would yield archaeological remains. But what was found there far exceeded the team's expectations, as they unearthed the remains of a 12th century blacksmith's, surrounded by both the objects and waste material it had produced. What's more, the site's date, and that of its sudden abandonment, has revealed a fascinating connection with a dark period in the history of the Fens. Headland Archaeology's Julie Franklin came on to discuss the find in more detail. In my conversation with her, I was joined by my Pastcast colleague, Carly Hiltz.
So, Julie, in your article for Current Archaeology, you talk about a Headland Archaeology excavation in Cheveley and how, Although you were expecting finds in a medieval village to be interesting, the team uncovered more than they anticipated. Could you tell us a bit about the smithy remains and how they were identified?
Yes, I can. The site was on the edge of the medieval village, so we were expecting to find some sort of medieval remains, but we didn't know exactly what we were going to get. What we had was a structure, a rectangular structure, and there wasn't much of it left. Medieval buildings, well, apart from the big posh ones like castles and abbeys, medieval buildings tend to be made out of wood. And so there's very little left, generally speaking. We had a foundation trench and a few post holes, but they appear to represent a rectangular structure. But the function of it, we mainly worked out because of the huge amount of slag we found on site, iron slag, which implies there'd been some iron work. And we also found various bits of iron work and a few tools as well. No metal tools, because the metal tools probably would have been of some value, so they would have taken those with them when they left. But we found two sharpening stones. One was a reused quern stone that had been used to sharpen points, and one was a whetstone that had been used to sharpen edges. So it put it all together with the assemblage of charcoal we found on site as well, and it seemed there was definitely some sort of iron working going on. So that's how we identified it.
Yeah, do you think you could give us an idea of the role of the smithy in 12th century society? And I'm also fascinated to know what it would have looked like and maybe smelled and even sounded like for someone who was walking past.
The role of the blacksmith was quite pivotal. It's still the centre of quite a lot of mythology, but the blacksmith was the one, he was in the middle between the high status people and everyday people, because they were needed to make weapons and horseshoes for nobility. They were also needed to make agricultural tools, domestic tools. So they were kind of a conduit between the high status people and the low status people. It would have been a part-time job in the early medieval period, at this period we're talking about. And it would have been during harvesting and ploughing, for example, they would have been needed to repair tools to keep the work going. And they probably would have been making stock during quiet periods in the agricultural calendar, like in summer and middle of winter. But iron was becoming increasingly important during this period. The population was increasing after the Norman invasion. It steadily increased, so more people would have needed more iron. There was also an increasing use of iron horseshoes. Iron horseshoes really weren't used in the Saxon period at all, but they became more and more common. So obviously the blacksmiths were becoming more and more important. By the 13th, 14th century, most villagers had their own blacksmith workshop. The fact that Cheveley had one at this period is probably either because there was a powerful manor around that supported it, or also the area was meant to be quite woody. And the fact that they had lots of wood was key, because obviously blacksmiths use a lot of wood. The typical fuel at this stage was charcoal. So there would have been charcoal burners working in the woodland around Cheveley and supplying the smithy with charcoal. It would have been the location of it. It was on the road that led into the village high street, but just outside the village. And it would have been quite a simple timber built structure with wattle and daub walls and a thatched roof probably. And it's the reason why blacksmiths tended to be located on the edge of the village rather than in the middle of the village is because they were quite noisy and they were quite smelly. The furnace would have been going constantly, belching out smoke. The noise of hammering would have been considerable. And also the considerable fire risk. Fire risk was a big thing in the medieval period when most houses were made out of wood. Just one spark and the whole village could have gone up. So anything that involved pyrotechnics like pottery production or ironworking tended to be shunted onto the outskirts of the village or even into the countryside, because just to get it away from everyone's wooden houses. So hence, that is where it was.
Grand. Talking about sort of hammering and the forge going and so on, in your article, you explore how the team was able to map the distribution of refuse on the site and sort of the differences between the locations of smithing slag and other projects. What insights does it give you into how the site operated and what was happening where?
Well, yes, we mapped where the slag was and where the charcoal was and where the iron was, where all the tools were. And I wasn't expecting to find what we found. I assumed that all of the ironworking stuff would be in the same location. But the slag and charcoal, as it turns out, were mostly up at the north of the site, mostly in this very tight cluster in the northwest. And there had been earlier geophysical survey which had identified a big iron anomaly up in that corner. And so it looks like there was ironworking going on there. But pretty much everything else we were looking at was concentrated around the rectangular structure in the middle of the site. That is domestic rubbish and the ironwork itself and the sharpening tools. So it appears to be that the smithing itself, the forge itself, was up at the northwest corner of the site, possibly just outside the excavation area, which is a little annoying, but that's the way it goes. But everything else was being done in the rectangular structure itself. So that is sharpening and possibly cold working, possibly copper plating, possibly making handles and scabbards and fixing those. All of those secondary processes would have needed good light. And they're also best done away from the heat and noise and the soot and the dirt of the forge. So you can see how it would be useful to keep the two things separate. It's also possible that a lot of that secondary working was done by the women and the children of the household, and it, which would therefore have been in conjunction with domestic duties. So again, it's better done around the structure, which we're assuming was their domestic residence as well. And there's also, for the same reason it's useful to have the forge on the outskirts of the village, it's useful to have the forge away from the domestic dwelling, because it limits the potential damage caused by fire. Just one spark from the forge, and you know, if their whole house and all of their winter grain supplies went up, wouldn't have been a good thing. But if they just burnt down the structure around the forge, not so much of an issue. So it appears to be that there was that distinct segregation between the two different processes going on at the forge, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
And we know that the site was occupied between around the 1100s and 1220. But there was also a notable period of abandonment in the 1140s and the 1150s. Now, this period coincides with an era known as the Anarchy. Can you tell us a bit more about what the Anarchy meant for the Cheveley area and the impact it may have had on the smithy and its surroundings?
Yes, I can. It all boils down to one man, really, Geoffrey de Mandeville. He was a very, very bad man. The background, obviously, is the Civil War, the succession conflict between Matilda and Stephen, which was raging from 1135 onwards, off and on until the succession of Henry II, who was Matilda's son. So it was a good 20 years of general civil war. For the most part, the area that Chievely was in was loyal to King Stephen. Geoffrey de Mandeville, throughout this conflict, had been playing both sides off against the other for his own personal gain. And by 1143, Stephen had just had enough of this. And so he arrested de Mandeville and stripped him of his castles, which included big castles like the Tower of London. And Geoffrey de Mandeville then rebelled quite spectacularly and set up a base on the Isle of Ely, which at the time, Ely is all dry land now, but at the time, the Isle of Ely was an area of relatively dry land surrounded by fens, and you could only get to it from causeways. And it was quite easily defendable, which de Mandeville knew because he'd been there before. And so he set up a base there and then set about attacking targets around the fen edge, mostly targeting royal sites and anything of strategic value. But lots of people flocked to his banner, lots of mercenaries and malcontents and generally bad people. And so he had to feed them and he had to satisfy their need for plunder. And so he ended up laying waste to pretty much the whole area around the fens, which would have included Chievely. And it was so bad that it caused depopulation and famine and depopulation for years to come. And so there are lots and lots of lurid stories about what went on in this period. But one of them is that towards the end, de Mandeville's followers disguised themselves as beggars, went out into the surrounding area and tried to work out which households had anything that was left worth stealing. And then they'd come back, armed men would come back in the dead of night, drag the people from the house out of their beds and torture them and make them tell them where their valuables were.
Yikes.
So it's possible that this is how the site Chievely met its end. This is how the blacksmith family met its end. It's not often that you get to tell stories like that in archaeology.
No.
But the dating just fits in so perfectly. Even if that did nothing quite so dramatic as that happened, the fact that there was depopulation caused by in this period meant that there would have been less need for iron. If the area was abandoned, the blacksmith obviously couldn't have plied his trade there, so he would have had to move on. It's possible also that because wars need iron work, obviously, so de Mandeville and King Stephen would both have needed a blacksmith. So it's possible that a blacksmith just moved to one of King Stephen's new castles in the area. Stephen moved in with a big force of men to try and rout out de Mandeville, obviously, and which he managed eventually. De Mandeville was killed about a year later by an arrow during a castle siege. So it's possible that the blacksmith was working in one of the Stephen's castles by that time, or had even gone to work for de Mandeville or been pressed into service of de Mandeville. So it's possible that he and his family did get to see old age, but the fact that the dating of the pottery and the radiocarbon dates imply that it was abandoned around the 1140s, and we know that there was this massive destruction happened in the 1140s, but the coincidence is does look like that is the reason, or something around that conflict is the reason why the site was abandoned.
And after this period, when it's all gone quiet, the Chievely site does see some short-lived use again, but it's ultimately abandoned after not much longer. Do you have any thoughts on why the site sort of came to an end in this way?
Yes, the site was, it looks like the site was reoccupied about 1180-ish, and again it was occupied for a few decades after that until possibly the 1220s. There are lots of prosaic reasons why it could have been abandoned again, and it could have been that the woodland was depleted, they had to wait for it to regenerate. It could have been that they had to move because of drainage issues. It could be that the manor provided a better accommodation elsewhere, and they moved, and or they just set up a site just next door that we're not finding. But um, I I did wonder, because I'd had such, because the history and archaeology fitted in so beautifully in the 1140s, I did wonder, I thought, I wonder if anything interesting happened in the 1220s. So I did a quick Google of it, not particularly expecting to find of it. Events of the 1220s, 1230s. and one of the first things that popped up was the murder of Richard Marshall. And I thought, that can't be the same Richard Marshall that happened to be one of the possible owners of Cheveley at the time, could it? And it was, it really was. Richard Marshall was a very powerful, very big landowner of the time. He was the son of the much more famous Will Marshall, who was for a time regent of England during the minority of Henry III. But this is a few decades after that. Richard Marshall managed to fall out with the now grown up Henry III in 1233. And Henry ordered Marshall's estate seized and destroyed. And it's the destroyed which is unusual. It was quite a common thing for people's estates to be seized if they fell out with the king at the time. But a seized and destroyed is quite unusual. It implies a very bad falling out. And also, Marshall was the owner of Cheveley at the time. That we don't know exactly, because there were three different possible landowners who were listed as owning land around Cheveley. And we don't know exactly whose land that our site was on. But if he was, then it's possible that, again, destruction was rained down upon Cheveley and as part of Marshall's estate. So, again, it's not quite as clear-cut as the 1140 abandonment, but it's just possible that this ties in with Richard Marshall's rebellion in 1233.
Wow. That was really, really interesting. Thank you.
Not at all.
Thanks again, Julie. You can read more about the Cheveley site in the latest issue of Current Archaeology, which is out now, as well as online at the PAST website. Also this week, I took advantage of the bank holiday sunshine and made a trip down to Portsmouth, where I saw the LCT 7074, a landing craft tank from the Second World War that has just been restored and opened to the public as part of the D-Day Story Museum in the neighbouring Southsea. After having a look around the renovated craft, which is the only one of its kind still in existence, I caught up with museum curator Andrew Whitmarsh outside by the seafront. Okay, Andrew, thanks very much for joining me today. We're approaching the anniversary of D-Day itself this week. As the museum's curator, I was just wondering if you could tell us how you feel about the museum finally being open to the public again.
It's really brilliant to be able to let visitors look around our museum, and of course now LCT 7074, after being closed, like, you know, all the other museums in this country for so long. So yes, it's just a real pleasure to have the public back and visiting us again. And it was really nice during lockdown. Obviously lots of really bad things happening, terrible things happening during lockdown, but we did get inquiries from people asking when we were going to open up, and so it was nice that there was interest in the public when we were going to reopen.
I've just had a look around the landing craft tank itself, and it is fantastic. I mean, it looks really brilliant in the sun and everything like that. It's so nice to look around, and undoubtedly it's the centrepiece of the museum. Can you tell me a bit more about the history of the landing crafts as a whole and the precise role it played in D-Day?
Sure. Well, I guess firstly I should just kind of sum up the whole project that has ended up with LCT 7074 being where it is. And actually the first thing I should probably say is give the size, which is about nearly 59 metres long. And one of the reasons I say start with that is because that's the first thing that most people seem to say when they see the LCT for the first time, is they say it's big. One of the great things about it, of course. And the whole project has been a partnership with the National Museum of the Royal Navy, who have sites around the country, but one of their main sites in Portsmouth, of course, like us. And so the National Museum of the Royal Navy owned the LCT. They secured the funding to restore it, to move it down to Portsmouth, and then to move it to its final, or its new site, here at the D-Day Story now. So we're working in partnership with them, and in a lot of ways we get the easy part of the deal, because we have the pleasure of displaying it to the public and allowing the visitors on to look around it as part of the visit to our museum. So it's an integral part of the visit and the ticket to our museum. But just to mention, to address the question you asked, so LCT stands for Landing Craft Tank, and as the name sort of suggests, they were designed for carrying large numbers of tanks and other vehicles, and they played a really important part on D-Day. So there were over 800 of them that were present on D-Day. Right from the very start, from about 8 hours when the first troops land, throughout the rest of the day, and then the week, days and weeks and months after that, they continued going back and forth across the English Channel, carrying more and more troops, supplies, etc. They carried pretty much anything, basically, because they were so flexible. So they were carrying more and more troops and supplies over to Normandy. So LCTs in general played a really crucial role. And one of the great things about LCT 7074 is that we know a lot about its history. It's not just sort of representative of any old LCT, but it's got a known detailed history. So it arrived off Gold Beach late on D-Day, late on the 6th of June 1944. And originally it had been planned to land its tanks towards the end of D-Day. Because things were a bit delayed, they ended up landing early on the 7th of June, the day after D-Day. And it was part of Naval Force L, which was a naval force carrying the sort of follow-up forces who weren't intended to seize the immediate beach area, but were going to come along behind the troops that had done that and then continue the advance inland.
Yes, and what troops would the LCT carry?
So LCT 7074 carried 10 tanks of the 7th Armoured Division, the Desert Rats, on D-Day. Then over subsequent trips, it quite often came back to Southampton. But 7074 was basically going back, like many, many other LCTs, was going back and forth to different places on both sides of the channel. Sometimes there's one occasion it's meant to have carried US airborne troops, for example, so that it wasn't a case that an LCT would go between one port and one D-Day beach in Normandy. They would go back and forth wherever they were needed, because basically it was a race against time in a lot of ways between the Allies trying to bring as many forces across the channel by sea versus the Germans trying to bring forces to Normandy by land. And obviously it's easier to do that by land, but then the Allies had done things like bomb bridges and railways to make it much harder. So it was part of this big, the Battle of the Build-Up, it's sometimes called, to build up the Allied forces in Normandy.
And then after the war, the LCT had quite a long retirement, even seeing use as a nightclub, is that right?
Yeah, so there were thousands and thousands of landing craft of different sizes built during the Second World War. When the war came to an end, the various Allied navies had no more use for them. Obviously, they kept a small number, but most of them, they just had no need. And really, they hadn't been built to last a long time anyway. They were not quite disposable, but just for sort of short-term use, because through use, going back and forwards across the channel, they would essentially get worn out. So some of them were sold off, and like, for example, you could even locally to Portsmouth and probably other places, you can even see some of the smaller landing craft types that have now been converted into houseboats that are still around. But 7074 was sold off initially to the Master Mariners in Liverpool, and they converted it into a floating club. So it was like a clubhouse where their members could go and have lunch, and they could hold formal meals and that kind of thing. And then as time went on, so that was straight after the war, that was I think 1948. As the years went on, the Master Mariners brought in an outside catering company to do the catering for them. And then in turn, that catering company used the LCT as a nightclub in the evenings. And then over time, the Master Mariners moved out and it became just a nightclub. And so it ran for many decades as a floating nightclub in Liverpool, but that meant that it's quite a sort of bizarre turn of events, but it meant that LCT 7074 survived. And one of the other considerations was that in doing all these sort of later uses, what people did was they built they added extra parts to LCT 7074. So the main space of the landing craft is the tank deck, which is essentially a big open space that you can fit as many vehicles in as possible, with the ramp at the bow door at the front to let them on and off. And they covered this over, so they roofed it over and then built other structures, other sort of rooms on top of that. But this was all pretty much all adding to the LCT. So when the National Museum of the Royal Navy some of it had already been taken off, but when all of that was removed, it left a more or less complete, not 100%, but pretty much complete 1944 landing craft that was revealed underneath that.
Yeah, so getting on to the restoration, it was restored in a multi-million pound project by the National Museum of the Royal Navy. Can you tell us a bit why? I mean, it's a fairly obvious question, really, but why you decided to restore it? And what kind of process, you know, how much work this involved?
Yeah, so the starting point really was that LCTs were very important in the role of D-Day, and this is the last surviving LCT that was there on D-Day, and one of only less than a handful surviving in the world in general. And it was in a, it was very much at risk of, it was actually at the point when the National Museum of the Royal Navy rescued it in 2014, 7074 was actually underwater. It sunk at its moorings, so it wasn't completely sunk, but was most of it was underwater. And that obviously made the process of restoring it quite complicated, because anything's made mostly from steel that's then been sitting around in water for long periods of time. Clearly there's problems with rust and so on. So there was a really long, complicated process that they went through to try and address the corrosion, and then to recoat it with paint. And also there's considerations like on the deck of the LCT now there's our two tanks that used to be outside our museum. So there's a Sherman Grizzly and a Churchill Crocodile. Clearly originally tanks could go onto the deck of an LCT no problem, because that's what it was designed for, but not anymore because of the decades that gone past. If you put the deck just couldn't take the weight of a tank normally, so those areas of deck have had to be specially reinforced to take the weight of the tank. There were some a few areas, not many really, but a few areas where that had been removed that from the original LCT, such as the very highest level of the superstructure, the bridge and the gun deck, where there's platforms for the two 20mm Oerlikon guns. So that had all come off at some point in the 40s or 50s or 60s or whenever it was, when it was being used as a club. So that was the National Museum of Royal Navy restored that area. So again, it looks like it would have done in 1944. So it was a really long and complicated process that, as I say, not to claim for credit for what we haven't done. The D-Day story was very pleased to be a partner, and we were sort of witnessing that rather than actually getting deeply involved in it. But yeah, it was definitely an enormous job. And then simply moving the LCTs here to our museum was also an enormous job. There were parallels with D-Day itself, because which I think stopped getting funny quite quickly once they started getting a bit difficult. But basically, the LCT was in Portsmouth Naval Base, so not in a public area, but behind the wire, so to speak, for the restoration. It came round on a barge to the South Sea seafront. It's not a very long distance, but it had to go on a barge to go that distance. Then it was landed on a kind of pad made of shingle, etc., that was sort of specially built so that this barge could come as close to the road running on the seafront as possible, so it could be unloaded at the right level. And that could only happen when there was a particularly high tide, and if there was bad weather just before that, it could sort of wash away this platform. So it was all a bit of a nightmare. Again, we were witnessing rather than leading on this, definitely. But it took a couple of goes, but they eventually managed to do it. And then wheeling it along the seafront to its final position. So it is an enormous logistical operation for the National Museum of the Royal Navy.
And yes, the restoration has allowed visitors to explore the interior of the landing craft tank. What kind of things can they see when they visit?
Well, I should probably just explain what it looks like briefly. So it's nearly 59 metres long. The main part of the LCT is the tank deck, which is an open space that could carry vehicles. When the visitor actually goes onto the landing craft, they go on via the ramp, which was what the vehicles would drive on and off using. And then you can go right to the back of the LCT, to the stern, into what was originally the engine room, and which is now a small sort of display gallery, basically, with where there's several films that you can find out more information about the history of the LCT, LCTs in general, and the part they played. Then you can go up some stairs to the first level, which is has the wheelhouse where the LCT was steered from, and the officers' quarters. So these spaces are all restored to look like they would have been in 1944. And then up a further ladder to the bridge and the gun deck, which is the highest level on the LCT. So the bridge obviously being where the commanding officer would be, and you can see the features have been added, like the compass that the craft had been steered with, and there was a voice pipe that the commanding officer would shout down to the coxswain in the wheelhouse with course changes, etc. And there's the engine room telegraph that the coxswain would then signal down to the engine room on the sort of third level down to signal course engine speed changes and that kind of thing. So you can get quite a sense of what it was like, the conditions were like for the crew, how the basics of how the landing craft operated. So you can also see the crew's quarters, which was right next to the engine room, so that probably wasn't great from a sound point of view, but I'm sure the crew just sort of got used to it. And they had the crew slept and ate in a steel box with no natural light. The conditions on board LCTs were recognised as being, by the Navy, as being quite hard, and the crews were given a special allowance to their pay to reflect that. My favourite sort of story to illustrate that is, apparently crews would often, so when they were sleeping in their hammocks, they would spread their waterproof clothing over the hammock, because you had a number of men sleeping in a small steel box, you just get so much condensation building up that it would drip onto the sailors from the ceiling. So yeah, fairly basic. So visitors will get a good idea of all of this sort of thing. And one of the great things about the landing craft is that people can look around and explore it.
And the museum itself, the museum building, which has recently been refurbished, holds over, I think it's 10,000 items relating to D-Day and the Normandy landings. Can you tell me a bit more about what else you've got on show here?
Yeah, so the D-Day story was refurbished and reopened in 2018. We opened in 1984 as the D-Day Museum, and so we've rebranded in 2018 as the D-Day story, reflecting the significance of the changes to our displays and the fact that we're trying to bring out the stories behind the objects on displays and behind the people who used or owned them. And our displays cover the story of D-Day and the Normandy campaign, from the planning and the preparations to all different aspects of that, through to D-Day, the Battle of Normandy, and then looking at the longer-term legacy of the campaign, the impact of their service on the veterans, how D-Day is commemorated, and then we have as part of the displays the Overlord embroidery, which is an 83-metre long embroidery, a sort of modern day equivalent of the Bayeux tapestry, telling the story of D-Day through 34 different embroidered panels. And that's a really amazing work of art that I think often catches people by surprise, and even sometimes people don't quite know what to expect. What's an embroidery doing in a museum about D-Day, but when they see it, they definitely get it and they're very impressed. So the rest of the museum kind of puts the LCT 7074 in context. It gives it that wider context, so the two of them work really well together.
Yes, thanks very much, Andrew. Thanks for joining me today.
Okay, pleasure. Thanks for visiting.
That's all for this week. Thanks to my guests, Julie Franklin and Andrew Whitmarsh, and to Carly for joining me. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider subscribing to us and sharing it around. The Pastcast is available every week on Spotify, Apple Music, Anchor, and from wherever else that you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us again soon.